than him, and in many cases just as strong-willed, he needed every advantage he could get. He straightened his tie and took his Phi Beta Kappa key from his vest pocket and began to twirl it on its lanyard, as he often did on such occasions. He gazed out over them for a moment, saying nothing, letting his attitude silence them. And then, without prelude, he began to tell them how it was going to be. "You will eat no fried meats," he began abruptly. "You will eat no pastries. But you will eat plenty of vegetables. You will eat good, substantial, wholesome food, the kind of food your mother makes. You will go to bed at 10 o'clock and arise punctually at 7 o'clock. You will not smoke or drink or chew. And you will follow this regimen all year round, for as long as you row for me. A man cannot abuse his body for 6 months and then expect to row the other 6 months. He must be a total abstainer all year. You will not use profane language in the shell house, nor anywhere within my hearing. You will keep at your studies and maintain a high grade point average. You will not disappoint your parents, nor your crewmates. Now let's row." Ulbrichsen's effort to knock the sophomores down a peg or two had mixed results. 2 weeks later, he made a move that inevitably revealed the extent of his high regard for them, though he tried to disguise it. When he first listed the tentative boatings, or crew rosters, for the new year on the blackboard in the shell house, everyone could see at a glance that 4 of the 5 potential varsity boats were crewed, as usual, by a mixture of boys from different classes. Some from last year's second freshman boat, some from each of last year's 2 JV boats, and some from last year's varsity boat. Just one boat was intact from last year. Joe's boat, the freshman first. For now, at least, the sophomores were to sit together just as they had in June, when bombs signifying their victory had exploded over the automobile bridge at Poughkeepsie. George Lund at bow, Shorty Hunt at 2, Joe Rance at 3, Chuck Hartman at 4, Delos Schock at 5, Bob Green at 6, Roger Morris at 7, Bud Schacht at stroke, and George Morey in the coxswain seat. The boat assignment seemed tangible and undeniable evidence that what the sophomores had been speculating about was true. Something was special about them, and Ulbrichsen had unusual confidence in them as a unit. But lest anyone, and particularly the sophomores themselves, read too much into it, Ulbrichsen put the boat far down the list that generally signified a crew's status in the program. The sophomore boys were not in the first boat or the second. They were, in fact, in the 5th boat. The lowest rung on the ladder, and the last place in which anyone would expect to see serious contenders for next spring's first varsity rowing. The boys did not know what to make of the mixed message. Although they were not particularly close, they were glad to be rowing together again, if only because they seemed to do it so well. But given their championship, they recognized what seemed an unwarranted demotion, and felt more than a little intimidated by their new coach's bearing. The swagger promptly disappeared from their steps. Ulbrichsen was a harder man than Bowles, and this season would clearly be harder than the last. As the fall training season got underway, Joe, in particular, struggled to keep up his spirits. It wasn't just the status of his boat that worried him. It wasn't just the brutality of the long workouts or the inevitable days of rowing in the rain and bitter cold. It was personal stuff. Despite the long summer of work, he found himself even poorer than he had been the previous year. Even the cost of a movie on a Saturday night now seemed unwisely extravagant to him. His dates with Joyce devolved into bleak meetings in the cafeteria, where they mixed ketchup with hot water and called it tomato soup, and rounded out the meal with soda crackers. The diamond ring on Joyce's finger comforted both of them. But at times, Joe could not help but look at it and wonder whether he would ever be able to live up to its implications. There were family matters eating at him as well. Joe had finally gone to his brother Fred and asked him point-blank where their father was. And Fred, after some hemming and hawing, had told him. Harry and Tula and Joe's half-siblings were living in Seattle. They had been there all along, in fact, since the night in 1929 when they had driven away and left Joe behind in Squim. They had moved at first into a dilapidated shed down on the waterfront on the fringes of the Hooverville. It wasn't a tar-paper shanty, but it wasn't much better. There were only 2 rooms. One, with a toilet and a sink, served as kitchen and bathroom. The other, with a wood stove in a corner, served as living room and bedroom for all six of them. At night, trucks rumbled by just a few inches from their front door. Prostitutes and toughs loafed under the street lamps down the way. Rats scurried about the corners of both rooms. Harry, unable to find the job they had come to Seattle seeking, went on the public dole. They didn't stay in the waterfront shed for long, but where they went next was only marginally better, an old house on Finney Ridge, west of Green Lake. The place had been built in 1885 and had not seen a repair or improvement since. It had only one electrical outlet and only one wood stove for heat. The stove did them little good anyway because they could not afford firewood to fuel it. Perched on the ridge, the house caught every wintry blast that blew down from the Arctic and into the city. Desperate to heat the house and put a little food on the table, Tula began to frequent local soup kitchens and a neighborhood commissary set up by the Unemployed Citizens League, an organization founded by local socialists. Dedicated to distributing food and firewood to the destitute, members of the league gleaned what they could in the way of partially spoiled crops in the fields of eastern Washington, and foraged for firewood in the Cascade Mountains, bringing whatever they could find back to Seattle. The pickings at the commissary were always slim, however. Most of the meals Tula managed to put before her children consisted of thin stews made from parsnips, rutabagas, potatoes, and chipped beef. Lacking wood for the stove most of the time, she took to turning her electric iron upside down, plugging it into one outlet, and cooking their stew on it. Tula's father had died in 1926, but her mother lived in a large house just a few blocks down the hill across Aurora Avenue near Green Lake. Mary La Follette had never been happy about Tula's marriage in the first place, and she was decidedly unhappy now with Harry and the way things had unfolded. The single concession she made to recognizing his family's plight was that every Sunday morning Tula was allowed to send her children to the house for bowls of cream of wheat. But that was it. One bowl of cream of wheat each week, and nothing more in the way of support. The ritual seemed designed to send a message. 80 years later, Harry Jr.'s voice still trembled when he remembered it. One bowl, once a week. I never could figure that out. Tula got the message, though. She told Harry to get out of the house and not come back until he had a job. Harry headed for Los Angeles. 6 months later, he returned with a motorcycle, but no job. Tula gave him another ultimatum, and finally, Harry did find a job as head mechanic with the Golden Rule Dairy and Bakery in Fremont. The Golden Rule was a fiercely non-union shop, which would, over the next few years, find itself at the center of a citywide boycott and labor battle, and as a result, wages were low. But they were wages, nonetheless, and Harry couldn't afford to be particular. He moved his family to a small but respectable house at 39th and Bagley, not far from the bakery, and not far from the north end of Lake Union, where Joe rode nearly every afternoon. That's where Joe found them in the fall of 1934, at an address that Fred finally provided. There wasn't much of a reunion. Joe and Joyce climbed into the Franklin and drove over to the house one afternoon. They parked on Bagley, took deep breaths, and climbed a flight of concrete steps to the front porch, holding hands. They could hear someone playing violin inside. Joe knocked on a yellow Dutch door, and the violin fell silent. A shadow moved behind the lace curtains on the upper half of the door. There was a moment's hesitation, and then Tula opened the door halfway. She did not seem particularly surprised to see them. Joe had the sense that she'd been expecting this for a long time. She glanced at Joyce and nodded at her pleasantly enough, but she made no move to invite them in. There was a long moment of silence. Nobody knew quite what to say. Joe thought Tula looked careworn and exhausted, much older than her 36 years. Her face was pale and drawn, her eyes a bit sunken. Joe focused for a moment on her fingers, red and chafed. Finally, Joe broke the silence. "Hello, Tula. We just came by to see how you were doing." Tula peered at him silently for a moment, her expression veiled, then dropped her eyes as she began to speak. "We're fine, Joe. We're doing fine now. How is school going?" Joe said it was going well, that he was on the crew now. Tula responded that she had heard that, and that his father was proud of him. She asked Joyce how her parents were doing, and expressed her regret when Joyce replied that her father was quite ill. Tula continued to hold the door just half open, her body blocking the entrance. Even as she addressed them, Joe noticed, she continued to look down at the porch, as if studying something at her feet, trying to find the answer to something there. Finally, Joe asked if he could come in and say hello to his father and the kids. Tula said that Harry was at work and the kids were visiting friends. Joe asked if he and Joyce could come back and visit them another time. Tula seemed suddenly to find what she had been looking for. She raised her eyes abruptly and leveled them at Joe. "No," she said, her voice colder now. "Make your own life, Joe. Stay out of ours." And with that, she closed the door gently and slid the deadbolt into position with a soft, metallic click. As they drove away from the house on Bagley that afternoon, Joyce simmered. Over the years, she had been slowly learning more about Joe's parents and what exactly had happened back in Squim, and before that, at the Gold and Ruby Mine. She'd learned about his mother's death and the long, lonely train ride to Pennsylvania. And stitching it all together, she could not understand how Tula could have been so cold to a motherless child, nor how Joe's father could have been so impassive in the face of it all. She could not understand either why Joe seemed to show so little anger about it all, why he continued to try to ingratiate himself with the two of them, as if none of it had ever happened. Finally, as Joe pulled over to the curb to drop her off at the judge's home, Joyce erupted. She demanded to know why Joe let his parents treat him as they did. Why did he go on pretending that they hadn't done him any harm? What kind of woman would leave a boy alone in the world? What kind of father would let her do that? Why didn't he ever get angry at them? Why didn't he just demand that they let him see his half-siblings? She was nearly sobbing by the time she finished. She glanced across the seat at Joe and saw at once, through a blur of tears, that his eyes were full of hurt, too. But his jaw was set, and he stared ahead over the steering wheel rather than turning to look at her. "You don't understand," he murmured. "They didn't have any choice. There were just too many mouths to feed." Joyce pondered that for a moment, then said, "I just don't understand why you don't get angry." Joe continued to stare ahead through the windshield. "It takes energy to get angry. It eats you up inside. I can't waste my energy like that and expect to get ahead. When they left, it took everything I had in me just to survive. Now I have to stay focused. I've just got to take care of it myself." Joe retreated into the life of the shell house. The boys still might razz him about his low taste in clothes and music, and he really was only comfortable around Roger and Shorty, but at least he felt he had purpose at the shell house. The rituals of rowing, the specialized language of the sport, the details of technique that he was struggling to master, the wisdom of the coaches, even their litany of rules and the various taboos they proscribed, all seemed to Joe to give the world of the shell house a measure of stability and order that for a long time now the outside world had seemed to him to lack. The brutal afternoon workouts left him exhausted and sore, but feeling cleansed, as if someone had scrubbed out his soul with a stiff wire brush. The shell house had become more of a home than the grim confines of his cubicle in the basement of the YMCA, or the half-built house out in Squim. He liked the way the light poured in through the windows of the enormous sliding doors, the stacks of burnished shells on their racks, the hiss of steam in the radiators, the banging of locker doors, the intermingled scents of cedar and varnish and sweat. He often lingered in the building long after practice was over, and more he found himself drawn to the back of the room and the stairs that led to Pocock's workshop. Joe would not think of going up the stairs uninvited, for fear of interrupting Pocock. There was a kind of reverence that attached to Mr. Pocock, as the boys invariably called him at all times. Not that Pocock cultivated the attitude. If anything, the opposite was true. He often stood on the floating dock as the boys got ready for a workout, fiddling with the riggers on this boat or that, chatting with the boys, occasionally offering up a nugget of wisdom or two, a suggestion that they try this or that adjustment to their stroke. In point of fact, Pocock, with only a lower school education, tended to believe that it was he, rather than these college men, who should be deferential. But Pocock was learned far beyond his formal education, as was immediately obvious to everyone who met him. He was well-read in a wide variety of subjects, religion, literature, history, and philosophy. He could quote Browning or Tennyson or Shakespeare at the drop of a hat, and the quote was always apt and telling, never pretentious or affected. The net effect was that for all his quiet humility, the man's wide-ranging knowledge and quiet eloquence commanded absolute respect, and never more than when he was at work in his shop plying his craft. No one interrupted Pocock at work. Ever. So Joe remained at the bottom of the stairs, looking up and wondering, but keeping his curiosity to himself. He noticed, though, that Pocock was at work in the shop a great deal these days, partly because rowing programs everywhere had gone so long following the crash of 1929 without ordering new equipment, and partly because the recent successes of Washington crews rowing in Pocock shells at Poughkeepsie, orders had suddenly begun coming into the shop again over the summer. Pocock now had a backlog of 8 orders for 8-man shells, including requests from some of the most elite rowing programs in the country: Navy, Syracuse, Princeton, and Pennsylvania. By the beginning of September, he was able to write Kai Ebright down in Berkeley in a tone markedly different from that of just a year before. He was too much of a gentleman to be vindictive, but he was now entirely confident. "If you're going to buy anything, old boy, I sure would advise not leaving it too late. We have taken terrific punishment the last 2 years, and the boys back east are waking up to the fact that they have got to get some equipment. That means we will be busy." When Ebright responded by questioning his prices, it was Pocock who now pushed back, firmly reiterating the amount. "The price on an 8 is $1,150. One thing is sure, Kai, I refuse to go into competition for the cheapest 8 in the country. I cannot build all of them, but I can still have a good shot at building the best." In fact, George Pocock was already building the best, and doing so by a wide margin. He didn't just build racing shells. He sculpted them. Looked at one way, a racing shell is a machine with a narrowly defined purpose: to enable a number of large men or women, and one small one, to propel themselves over an expanse of water as quickly and efficiently as possible. Looked at another way, it is a work of art, an expression of the human spirit, with its unbounded hunger for the ideal, for beauty, for purity, for grace. A large part of Pocock's genius as a boat builder was that he managed to excel both as a maker of machines and as an artist. Growing up and learning his trade from his father at Eton, he had used simple hand tools, saws, hammers, chisels, wood planes, and sanding blocks. For the most part, he continued to use those same tools, even as more modern labor-saving power tools came to market in the 1930s. Partly this was because he tended strongly toward the traditional in all things. Partly it was because he believed that the hand tools gave him more precise control over the fine details of the work. Partly it was because he could not abide the noise that power tools made. Craftsmanship required thought, and thought required a quiet environment. Mostly, though, it was because he wanted more intimacy with the wood. He wanted to feel the life in the wood with his hands, and in turn impart some of himself, his own life, his pride, and his caring, into the shell. Up until 1927, he made his shells precisely as his father had taught him to make them in England. Working on a perfectly straight I-beam more than 60 feet long, he constructed a delicate framework of spruce and northern ash. Then he carefully joined and nailed strips of Spanish cedar to the ribs of the frame to form the hull. This required thousands of brass nails and screws, the heads of which had to be patiently and laboriously filed down by hand before he could apply coats of marine varnish to the exterior. The fitting and nailing on of the planks was labor-intensive and nerve-wracking. At any moment, the slip of a chisel or a careless blow from a hammer could ruin days' worth of work. In 1927, he made an improvement that revolutionized the building of racing shells in America. For a number of years, Ed Leader, who succeeded Hiram Conybeare as the Washington crew coach, had suggested that Pocock try making a shell out of the native western red cedar, that grew so abundantly and so large in Washington and British Columbia. After all, Spanish cedar was expensive, having to be imported from its native South America. Spanish cedar, Cedrela adorata, is in fact neither Spanish nor cedar, being a member of the mahogany family. It was also notoriously brittle, necessitating the almost continual repair of the school's fleet of shells. Pocock was attracted to the idea of trying the native cedar. He had for years taken notice of the lightness and the durability of the old cedar Indian canoes that still occasionally plied the waters of the Puget Sound. But he had been dissuaded from experimenting with it by head coach Rusty Callow. Callow had been a logger in his younger years, and like most lumbermen, he believed that cedar was only good for making shakes and shingles. But when Pocock finally followed his own heart and began to experiment with the wood in 1927, he was astonished by the possibilities it opened up. Western red cedar, Thuja plicata, is a kind of wonder wood. Its low density makes it easy to shape, whether with a chisel, a plane, or a handsaw. Its open cell structure makes it light and buoyant, and in rowing, lightness means speed. Its tight, even grain makes it strong but flexible, easy to bend, yet disinclined to twist, warp, or cup. It is free of pitch or sap, but its fibers contain chemicals called thujaplycins that act as natural preservatives, making it highly resistant to rot, while at the same time lending it its lovely scent. It is beautiful to look at, it takes finish well, and it can be polished to a high degree of luster, essential for providing the smooth, friction-free racing bottom a good shell requires. Pocock quickly became a convert. Soon he was scouring the Northwest for the highest quality cedar he could find, making long journeys to smoky sawmills out on the Olympic Peninsula, and far to the north in the still virgin forests of British Columbia. He found just what he wanted in the misty woods surrounding Lake Cowichan on Vancouver Island. From the cedar stock he found there, long, tight-grained, straight sections cut from massive, ancient trees, he could mill elegant planks of wood 20 inches or more wide and 60 feet long. And from these planks he could shave identical pairs of much thinner planks, delicate sheets of cedar, just 5/32 of an inch thick, each a mirror image of the other, with the same pattern of grain. By placing these book-matched pairs on either side of the keel, he could assure perfect symmetry in the boat's appearance and performance. These flexible sheets of cedar also allowed Pocock to do away with the endless nailing of planks to the boat's ribs. Instead, he could simply strap the sheets of wood over the frame of the boat, forcing them to conform to its shape, then cover the whole assembly with heavy blankets and divert steam from the shell house's heating system under the blankets. The steam caused the cedar to relax and bend to fit itself to the shape of the frame. When he turned off the steam and removed the blankets 3 days later, the cedar sheets held their new shape perfectly. All he had to do was dry them and glue them to the frame. It was the same technique that the Coast Salish peoples of the Northwest had used for centuries to fashion bentwood boxes out of single planks of cedar. The sleek shells that resulted from the process were not only more beautiful than the Spanish cedar shells, but also demonstrably faster. Harvard ordered, as an experiment, one of the first to come out of Pocock's shop, and promptly reported back that the boat had taken several full seconds off its crew's best times. With the cedar skin attached to the shell, Pocock installed the runners and the seats, the riggers, the rudder assembly, and the trim. He took pride in using a variety of Northwest woods in his products. Sugar pine for keels, ash for the frames, Sitka spruce for the gunnels and the hand-carved seats, Alaska yellow cedar for the washboards. The last of these he favored mostly because as it aged its color evolved from that of old ivory to a golden honey hue that harmonized with the burnished red of the cedar hulls. He stretched sheer silk fabric over the stern and bow sections and painted the silk with varnish. As the varnish dried and hardened on the fabric, it created a fragile and lovely translucent yellow decking fore and aft. Finally, he worked on the finish, hand-rubbing the cedar hull with powdered pumice and rotten stone for hours, applying thin coats of marine varnish, then rubbing the finish again and again until it gleamed like still water. All told, it took 4 gallons of varnish to get the finish he was looking for. Only when it fairly shimmered, when it seemed in its sleekness to be alive with the potential for speed, did Pocock pronounce the boat ready for use. There was one more thing about cedar, a sort of secret that Pocock had discovered accidentally after his first shells made of the wood had been in the water for a while. People had taken to calling them banana boats, because once they were exposed to water, both their bows and sterns tended to curve ever so slightly upward. Pocock pondered this effect and its consequences, and gradually came to a startling realization. Although cedar does not expand or swell across the grain of the wood when wet, and thus tends not to warp, it does expand slightly along the grain. This can amount to as much as an inch of swelling in the length of a 60-foot shell. Because the cedar was dry when attached to the frame, but then became wet after being used regularly, the wood wanted to expand slightly in length. However, the interior frame of the boat, being made of ash that remained perpetually dry and rigid, would not allow it to expand. The cedar skin thus became compressed, forcing the ends of the boat up slightly and lending it what boat builders called camber. The result was that the boat as a whole was under subtle but continual tension caused by the unreleased compression of the skin, something like a drawn bow waiting to be released. This gave it a kind of liveliness, a tendency to spring forward on the catch of the oars in a way that no other design or material could duplicate. To Pocock, this unflagging resilience, this readiness to bounce back, to keep coming, to persist in the face of resistance, was the magic in cedar, the unseen force that imparted life to the shell. And as far as he was concerned, a shell that did not have life in it was a shell that was unworthy of the young men who gave their hearts to the effort of moving it through the water. At the end of October, Ebright wrote back to Pocock. If he was going to order a new shell, he wanted it custom designed. He wanted one with less camber. Pocock was horrified. After alleging that Pocock had sent him inferior equipment, Ebright was now demanding a boat that simply would not go as fast as Pocock's best, a boat that would not reflect well on him as a craftsman. Pocock wrote back with a long, detailed technical explanation of his design, and proposed a few minor modifications that he thought might mollify Ebright without compromising the integrity of the shell. Ebright replied testily with technical arguments of his own, and then continued, "I think you know as much about boat building as anyone in the world, but perhaps new ideas might be advantageous to all of us. I doubt if you will like the tone of this letter, George." Pocock did not like the tone of the letter at all, but he let it slide. He had orders from virtually every major rowing program in the country. Ebright could order a shell or not, as he chose. And in time, Ebright did finally order one. When it was finished, Pocock paid 8 of the boys $1 each to deliver it to the docks in Seattle, so it could be shipped south. The boys rowed it through the cut and to the south end of Lake Union. There they removed it gingerly from the water, inverted it over their heads, and began a mile-and-a-half portage across Seattle. A 16-legged cedar turtle, more than 60 feet long, they crossed Mercer Street and headed south on Westlake, plunging into downtown traffic. With their heads under the shell, they could see little except for their own feet and the back of the man ahead of them, so a coxswain ran ahead of them, waving his hands to warn oncoming vehicles to steer clear, and simultaneously shouting out instructions in rowing terms. "Way enough, boys. Hard to port. Pick her up." They dodged streetcars and buses, swung wide around each corner, peered out from under the shell from time to time to get their bearings. As they jogged to their right and entered the shopping district on 4th Avenue, people stopped on the sidewalk or rushed out of storefronts to watch them pass, staring, snickering, and applauding. Finally, they turned right on Columbia, followed the steep descent to the waterfront, scurried hastily across railroad tracks, and made it safely to the docks. There they sent the shell on its way to California, where they would soon race against it on the Oakland estuary. Tensions began to mount in the Washington shell house that October. The continuing rumors that the sophomores might be pegged for the first varsity boat in the spring had everyone on edge. Al Ulbrichsen remained characteristically silent on the topic, but the older boys fretted that that in itself seemed an ominous sign. Why didn't he just put the rumors to rest and say the sophomores would have their crack at the varsity boat the following year, as usual? As boys suited up and hoisted oars in and out of the racks, there was little of the usual banter and joshing. Icy stares began to replace good-natured grins. On the water, occasional catcalls flew from boat to boat when the coaches weren't in earshot. As the mood in the shell house deteriorated, so too did the weather. At first, it was just the usual fall drizzle. But then, on the morning of October 21st, all hell broke loose as the next in a series of extreme weather events that characterized the mid-1930s unfolded. An enormous cyclonic windstorm, a storm that made the previous fall's windstorm look almost like a spring breeze, slammed into Washington State. It seemed to come out of nowhere. At 9 in the morning, there was nothing more than a light chop on Lake Washington, a typical gray late fall day with light winds out of the southeast at perhaps 5 miles per hour. An hour later, sustained winds were blowing out of the southwest at 50 miles per hour. By noon, gusts up to 75 miles per hour were screaming over Lake Washington. At Aberdeen, on the coast, winds hit 90 miles per hour. It was the greatest windstorm the Seattle area had ever seen. At Pier 41, the Trans-Pacific Ocean liner President Madison snapped her hawsers and careened into the steamboat Harvester, sinking her. Off Port Townsend, the Perse seiner Agnes also sank, drowning 5 Seattle fishermen. 30 passengers had to be rescued from the Virginia V, one of the last of the city's historic mosquito fleet, when she smashed into a wharf and her superstructure was crushed. Out in the countryside, barn roofs and entire outhouses flew away. An airplane hangar at Boeing Field, then Seattle's principal airport, collapsed, destroying several aircraft inside. At the Alki Hotel, a brick wall collapsed, killing a Chinese boarder in his bed. In Hooverville, tin roofs cartwheeled across the sky, and shanties were simply shredded, leaving their denizens standing dazed among the wreckage. At a nearby bakery, hungry men gathered in front of the plate glass window separating them from racks of freshly baked bread, hoping the window would implode. On the University of Washington campus, the glass skylights at the basketball pavilion caved in, giant Douglas firs toppled over, and 5 sections of temporary seating in the football stadium blew away. The winds blew for 6.5 hours, almost without respite, and when they finally died down, millions of board feet of standing timber had fallen, millions of dollars of property damage had been done, 18 people were dead, and Seattle was largely cut off from communication with the outside world. Then the rains came again, as they always do. It was not quite the deluge of the previous year, but it rained more days than not for the rest of October and into November. An unusual number of lesser windstorms continued to blow in from the Pacific as well. One of the few advantages West Coast crews were supposed to have over East Coast crews was that the Easterners could not train out of doors during the winter when their home rivers were frozen. Instead, they were usually relegated to indoor rowing tanks, poor substitutions for the real thing. Like sitting on the edge of a bathtub with a shovel, one Western coach scoffed. As a result of all their outdoor exposure, Washington's boys were, year after year, particularly hardy and particularly adept in rowing rough water. But you could not row at all if your shell sank, and as November of 1934 wore on, the water was so rough that it continually threatened to swamp the boats. Day after day, Ulbrichtsen had to keep them ashore. He drove his boys hard, but he wasn't about to let a boatload of them drown in the middle of Lake Washington. By mid-November, he figured he was 2 weeks behind schedule. Throughout that month, a world away at the lavish Geyerwerke Film Studios on Harzerstrasse in Berlin, Leni Riefenstahl was peering day and night with weary but zealous eyes through the double magnifying lenses of her small Leitax film editing machine. Dressed in a white smock, she sat at her editing table for up to 16 hours a day, often until 3 or 4 in the morning, seldom eating, surrounded by thousands of film strips dangling from hooks in front of backlit glass walls. The immediate task at hand was to carefully review, cut, and splice selections from the 400,000 feet of raw film she had shot at the 1934 Nazi Party rally in Nuremberg. The film that would eventually emerge from her labors, Triumph of the Will, Triumph des Willen, would come to define the iconography of Nazi Germany. To this day, it stands as a monument to the ability of propaganda to foster absolute power and to justify unfettered hatred. And Riefenstahl would be celebrated for it for the rest of her life. The Nuremberg Rally of 1934 was itself an anthem to power and a carefully designed tool for further concentrating and advancing it. From the moment Adolf Hitler's airplane descended from the clouds into Nuremberg on September 4th of that year, every movement he made, every detail of the imagery that unfolded, every word he and his minions spoke was carefully calculated to reinforce the notion that the Nazi Party was invincible. And more, that it was the only legitimate object of not just political, but religious fervor. And still more, that this new German religion was embodied and made incarnate in the person of its leader. The rally's principal choreographers were Albert Speer, Hitler's chief architect, who designed the massive movie set Nuremberg became, Joseph Goebbels, who controlled the overall propaganda value of the event, its messaging in modern parlance, and Leni Riefenstahl, whose job it was to capture on film not just the rally itself, but more important, its underlying spirit, to amplify its message and convey it to an audience far wider than the 750,000 party members who were actually in Nuremberg that week. It was a tense, strained alliance, particularly between Riefenstahl and Goebbels. As Riefenstahl's influence continued to grow, Goebbels increasingly struggled to comprehend how a woman could occupy such a situation, much as he struggled to understand why his wife objected so strenuously to his many affairs. After the war, Riefenstahl said she initially hesitated to make the film, fearing interference from Goebbels and his powerful Ministry of Propaganda. In her enormously self-serving and revisionist autobiography, she asserted that she agreed to make the film only after Hitler promised to keep Goebbels at bay. She also claimed that she had already had to keep Goebbels at bay on a more personal level, that he had become so smitten with her charms, so determined to have her for his mistress, that he had come to her apartment one night and flung himself on his knees at her feet, begging her to have him, only to be unceremoniously shown the door. Goebbels, she said, never forgave her for the humiliation of the rejection. Despite all this, and regardless of the veracity of Riefenstahl's account of her relationship with Goebbels, the 1934 rally, and Riefenstahl's film in particular, were enormous successes. Triumph of the Will was everything Riefenstahl hoped it would be, and it is still considered by many to be the most successful propaganda film of all time. With a staff of 172, including 18 cameramen dressed as SA men so they would blend into the crowd, Riefenstahl shot the week's events from every conceivable angle, using techniques that had never been tried in a documentary before. Cameras on dollies moving along tracks, cameras mounted on elevator platforms for dynamic aerial views, cameras in pits dug at ground level for shots upward at the looming Nazi figures. And the cameras caught it all. 500,000 uniformed party members marching in thunderous lockstep, standing in massed rectangular formations, perfect in their uniformity and conformity. The speeches by Rudolf Hess, Goebbels, and Hitler himself, pounding on the podium, eyes ablaze, spittle flying from his mouth, Speer's monumental architecture, the ponderous stone buildings lending their weight and solidity to the impression of overwhelming might, the vast open spaces suggesting unlimited ambition, the eerie torchlight parade of the SA men on the second night, with flickering torches and magnesium flares and bonfires illuminating their gleaming faces against the black night, the ranks of black-shirted SS men goose-stepping past bespectacled, crab-faced Heinrich Himmler, enormous banners emblazoned with swastikas, fluttering in the background of nearly every shot. If you have in your mind any image of Nazi pageantry and power, it likely comes, directly or indirectly, from Triumph of the Will. But perhaps the most horrifying images from Riefenstahl's film were seemingly the most innocent. They were shot on the third day of the rally, as Hitler addressed tens of thousands of boys from the Hitlerjugend, the Hitler Youth, and its junior branch, the Deutsches Jungvolk. Service in the Hitler Youth was not yet compulsory, as it would later be. These were boys who were already true believers, and they had been indoctrinated with a fierce anti-Semitism. Dressed in short pants and khaki shirts and neckerchiefs, looking for all the world like Boy Scouts, with swastikas on their armbands, they ranged in age from 18 down to 10. Many of them were destined to become members of the SS, or SA. On the podium, Hitler addressed them directly, jabbing at the air with one arm, his fist clenched. "We want our people to be obedient," he ranted, "and you must practice obedience. Before us, Germany lies. In us, Germany burns. And behind us, Germany follows." On the field, Riefenstahl's cameras moved slowly up and down the ranks of the boys, lenses angled slightly upward toward their faces. A gentle autumn breeze tousled their mostly fair hair. Their eyes shone with zeal, illuminated by trust. Their faces were so full of grace, so free of blemish, so perfect that even today, even in the old black-and-white film, you can almost see the pink blush of their cheeks. And yet, many of these were the faces of young men who would someday pull sobbing children from their mother's arms and herd them into gas chambers, who would order Polish women to strip naked, line them up at the edge of trenches, and shoot them in the back, who would lock all the women and children of the French town of Oradour-sur-Glane in a barn and set it on fire. Leni Riefenstahl did her work well, and Hitler was pleased. A little less than 2 years later, in 1936, she had an opportunity to make another propaganda film, one that would again revel in images of youth and beauty and grace, and that would again perpetrate a great and sinister fraud upon the world. As the fall quarter at the university wound down, Joe headed home to Squim to spend Christmas with Joyce and her family. All fall he had been looking forward to winter break, and to spending time with Joyce somewhere other than in the dreary student cafeteria. As he got ready to leave town, though, a headline in the Daily caught his attention. "Senior men face life with debts, few jobs." The article made his heart sink. The average debt among graduates was $200, it said, and the average four-year tab was more than $2,000. Both were staggering amounts of money for someone like Joe in 1934. But what surprised him most as he read on, what he remembered years later, was the revelation that more than half the men interviewed are receiving their university education at no expense to themselves, their expenses being paid by parents or relatives who expect no reimbursement. The whole premise of Joe's struggle to stay in school was the prospect of a more promising future afterward. It had not occurred to him that doors wouldn't just open for a man with a college degree. And once again, it was pounded home to him how many of his classmates apparently did not even have to think about money, how many had people watching out for them, shelling out thousands of dollars they never expected to see again. It stirred up the old anxiety and self-doubt that always threatened to bubble to the surface, and it added something new to the mix, a toxic dash of jealousy. Part 3, 1935, The Parts That Really Matter. Chapter 9. One of the first admonitions of a good rowing coach, after the fundamentals are over, is pull your own weight. And the young oarsman does just that when he finds out that the boat goes better when he does. There is certainly a social implication here. George Yeoman Pocock. The boys sat on hard benches, shivering in their mismatched shorts and cotton jerseys. The sun had already set, and the vast interior space of the shell house was drafty and uncomfortable. Outside, it was a bitterly cold night. The panes of glass on the great sliding doors were frosted at the corners. It was the evening of January 14, 1935, the first crew turnout of the new year. The boys and a handful of reporters were waiting for Al Ulbrichtsen to lay out his plan for the upcoming racing season. After a long, uncomfortable wait, Ulbrichtsen emerged from his office and began to talk. By the time he finished, nobody in the room was cold any longer. He had started off simply, announcing a change of basic strategy. Instead of taking it relatively slow for the first few weeks of winter quarter, as they generally did, working on details of form and technique while waiting for the weather to improve, they were going to row all out every day, right from the outset this year, weather be damned. They were going to work themselves into top physical condition first, and then worry about refining technique later. More than that, though, all of them, not just the sophomores, were going to start out by racing one another in set crews rather than in constantly changing mixtures of men. And the races would be for the highest of stakes. This was not going to be an ordinary season. At one time or another, he declared, Washington crews have won the highest honors in America. They have not, however, participated in the Olympic Games. That's our objective. The push to go to Berlin in 1936 and to win gold there was to begin that night. Casting aside his usual reticence and despite the presence of reporters in the room, Ulbrichsen then began to grow animated, almost emotional. There was more potential in this room, he said, than he had ever seen in a shell house in all his years of rowing and coaching, more than he ever expected to see again in his lifetime. Somewhere among them, he told the boys, was the greatest crew that Washington had ever seen. Better than the great 1926 crew that he had himself stroked to victory at Poughkeepsie. Better than the great Cal crews that had won Olympic gold in 1928 and 1932. Maybe the best Washington would ever see. 9 of them, he wound up declaring, as if it was a certainty, were going to be on the medal podium in Berlin in 1936. It was up to each of them whether he would be there or not. When he finished, the boys leapt to their feet and cheered, applauding with their hands held over their heads. The performance was so uncharacteristic of Al Ulbrichsen that everyone in Seattle with any interest in rowing took note. The next morning, the Seattle Post-Intelligencer exulted, "A new era in Washington rowing, possible entry in the Olympic Games in Berlin." The Washington Daily reported that, despite the intense cold, the shell house radiated more fire and spirit last night than has been the case for many a year. All-out war promptly broke out in the shell house. The sullen rivalries that had arisen during the fall season now turned into outright battles. Eyes that had been coolly averted from one another before, now locked in icy stares. Accidental bumping of shoulders turned into open pushing matches. Locker doors were slammed, curses were exchanged. Grudges were nursed. Brothers Sid and George Lund, one in the all-sophomore boat, one in a JV boat, now barely greeted each other with grunts each afternoon. The 9 boys in the all-sophomore boat were sure that Ulbrichsen had been talking directly to and about them. They changed their MIB rowing chant to LGB. When asked what it meant, they smiled and said, "Let's get better." It didn't. It meant, "Let's go to Berlin." It became a kind of secret code embodying their ambitions. But they were still listed on the chalkboard as boat number 4 out of 5, no matter what they chanted out on the water. And Ulbrichsen, publicly at least, seemed to have other boys at the front of his mind these days. In particular, over the next few weeks, he seemed to make a point of talking to any reporter he could find about the golden prospects of a potential stroke oar for the varsity, a boy named Bruceus C. Beck, Jr. Beck's father had been the manager of Seattle's iconic Beaumarchais department store, and a fierce opponent of organized labor, famous for hiring spies who infiltrated the unions and reported back to him. He had also been an outstanding stroke on the Washington crew of his day, and later chairman of the board of rowing stewards at Washington. His own father had been one of Seattle's most prominent pioneers, establishing a large homestead in the city's Ravenna Park area just north of the university. The business community and a good number of alumni very much wanted to see the young Beck stroking the Washington varsity now. He may or may not have had the kind of potential Ulbrichsen talked about, but there was no doubt that he was the kind of boy coaches like to keep around, to make the alums happy. Joe, for one, took note of it. Beck was pretty clearly one of the boys who didn't have to worry about money, or about a clean shirt to wear. Joe wondered if he had to worry about much of anything. Ulbrichsen's plan, to have the boys row themselves quickly into fighting form, ran into trouble starting the day after his fiery speech. The Daily's next headline told the tale, or at least the beginning of it. "Sweepsters turn out with icicles on their oars." The weather, which had been wet and blustery since late October, now turned arctic. On the night of Ulbrichsen's talk, cold north winds blew enormous breakers in off Puget Sound, pushing salt water 2 blocks inland at Alki Beach and along the waterfront in West Seattle. Over the next several days, temperatures dropped into the teens. Snow flurries turned into light snowstorms, which in turn became full-scale blizzards. The siege went on almost continually, well into the 3rd week of January. As he had in the fall, Ulbrichsen had to keep his crews in the shell house day after day, or at best turn them out for quick sprints up and down the cut, rowing in the snow until their hands grew so numb they could no longer hold the oars. He never said so, but he must have begun to wish he had some of those indoor rowing tanks they had back east. The Eastern boys, at least, were at their oars, while his sat cooped up in a shell house, staring out the windows at some of the best rowing water in the world. As the weather worsened, Tom Bowles watched his freshman squad rapidly shrink from the 210 who had turned out in the fall to 53 on January 14th. By the third week of January, the Daily noted, "Three more days of blizzard, and Tom Bowles won't have a frosh crew." Bowles, though, seemed unperturbed. "Crew is one sport where a cut is not necessary," he observed. And though Bowles wasn't talking much about it yet, he was well aware that among those few boys who were showing up there was some outstanding talent. He was starting to think, in fact, that he might just put together a freshman crew that could beat even last year's bunch. By the time the snow finally turned to rain, in late January, the campus was mired in 532 acres of slush, and the infirmary was so overrun with students suffering from colds, flu, and pneumonia that all the beds were full, and six students were left lying on cots in the hallways. Ulbrichsen hustled all five boatloads of varsity contenders back out onto the water in the wind and the rain. The war that had been simmering in the shell house became a full-on naval engagement. On January 24th, another item in the Daily got things started. Under a large photograph of Joe and the sophomores rowing the city of Seattle, a bold caption read, "They dream of Poughkeepsie and Olympics." The accompanying headline read, "Frosh crew champs of last year look good to Coach Ulbrichsen." Last year's varsity boys were outraged. It had seemed for months as if Ulbrichsen had been quietly favoring the younger boys, but it had been subtle. Now it was all out in the open, down in black and white, for them and their friends, and worse, their girlfriends, to read. By all appearances, they were going to be shunted aside, humiliated for the sake of Ulbrichsen's all-too-precious sophomores. One of the boys in the all-sophomore boat, Bob Green, had the habit of getting excited and shouting encouragement to his crewmates during races. It was something of a breach of protocol, as ordinarily it is only the coxswain who is at all verbal in a shell, and it had the potential to confuse the stroke, especially during a race. But it had seemed to work for the sophomores the year before, and George Morey, the usual sophomore coxswain, had put up with it good-naturedly. It irritated the hell out of some of the older boys in the other boats, though, particularly Bobby Mock, the savvy little coxswain of what seemed to be shaping up as the best of the JV boats. As the boats began to compete head-to-head for varsity status in February, Mock, a junior, grew more and more outraged by Green's behavior. But he soon found that he could turn it to his own advantage. Whenever his boat came up alongside Joe and the sophomores, Mock quietly leaned toward his stroke oar and whispered, "Give me 20 really big ones after five more." Green, meanwhile, would be hooting and hollering at his own crew, urging them on. Five strokes later, Mock would direct his megaphone over to the sophomore boat and say, "Well, Green just opened his big mouth again. Let's pass them." By the time he said this, his own boat would already be starting to surge, as if by magic. In the sophomore boat, Green, angry at the name-calling, would start yelling even more loudly. In the coxswain seat, Morey would chime in, "Give me 10 big ones." But all the while, Mock's boat would be silently accelerating away from them. Each time Mock tried it, the sophomores did the same thing. All at once, collectively and in unison, they lost their cool. They flailed at their oars, digging them too deep in the water, or too shallow, out of time with one another, angry and desperate to catch up, losing all semblance of form. Time after time they got, as Mock called it, all bloody-nosed, and none more so than Joe, to whom the whole thing seemed like another joke at his expense, designed to show him up. But it always worked. Mock wound up each time sitting in the stern of his boat, looking back over his shoulder, chuckling at the suddenly hapless-looking sophomores as they fell out of contention, and giving them the casual farewell wave. Bobby Mock, as everyone concerned would eventually learn, was nobody's fool. Neither was Al Ulbrichsen, though he was starting to have some serious doubts about the sophomores. He had frankly expected that by now they would emerge decisively as the new varsity lineup. But watching them suddenly struggle against even the JV boys, they just didn't look like the crew that had won with such astonishing ease at Poughkeepsie. They seemed to be going all to hell. He studied them for a few days, trying to figure it out, looking for individual faults. Then he called those who seemed to be struggling the most, George Lund, Chuck Hartman, Roger Morris, Shorty Hunt, and Joe Rance, into his office for a talk. It wasn't quite the whole boat, but pretty nearly so. It was an intimidating thing to be summoned into Al Obrigson's office. It didn't happen often, and it left an impression when it did. On this occasion, as on most, he didn't shout or pound the table, but he sat the boys down, leveled his gray eyes at them, and told them flat out that they were all in danger of falling out of contention for the boat if they didn't shape up. They were messing up his plan to keep their crew intact. And wasn't that what they wanted? If so, then why weren't they rowing as they did at the championship? It looked to him like a case of laziness. They weren't pulling hard enough. They had no pepper. And they were sloppy. They were knifing their oars into the water rather than digging into it. They weren't putting their backs into it. Their spacing was all off. Worst of all, they were letting their emotions climb into the boat with them, losing their cool over little things. And that had to stop. By way of closing, he reminded them that there were at least four boys vying for each seat in the first varsity boat. Then he stopped talking and simply pointed at the door. The boys came out of the shell house shaken, trying to ignore a cluster of seniors and juniors smirking at them from the doorway. Joe, Roger, and Shorty started up the hill in the rain, talking over what had just happened, beginning to get agitated. Shorty and Roger had been buddies from day one. Shorty was so naturally garrulous and Roger so naturally reticent and gruff that it seemed an odd combination, but somehow it worked for them. And Joe was grateful that the two of them had never given him a hard time. In fact, more and more, Joe could count on the pair of them to come to his side when the older boys teased him. Shorty rode in the number two seat, right behind Joe, and he'd taken lately to looping an arm over Joe's shoulder whenever he seemed down and saying, "Don't worry, Joe, I've got your back." Hunt was an extraordinary young man by anybody's reckoning. Just how extraordinary, nobody yet quite knew. But just a few years down the line, Royal Brougham would name him, along with Al Obrigson, as one of the two greatest oarsmen ever to sit in a shell for Washington. Like Joe, he had grown up in a small town, Puyallup, between Tacoma and the foothills of Mount Rainier. Unlike Joe's, his family life had been stable, and as a result, he'd grown comfortable with himself and highly accomplished. At Puyallup High School, he had been a superstar. He had played football, basketball, and tennis. He was class treasurer, an assistant librarian, a member of the radio club, and he appeared on the honor roll every year that he attended the school. He was active in the Honor Society and the school's high-y chapter, and he graduated 2 years early. He was also quite good-looking, with wavy dark hair. People liked to compare him to Cesar Romero. He was 6'3" as a freshman, and his fellow students promptly dubbed him Shorty. He'd use the name for the rest of his life. He was something of a fashion plate, always well-dressed and forever drawing the eyes of the young women around him, though he did not seem to have a steady girl. Despite his accomplishments, he was also something of a contradiction. He was garrulous and sociable and loved to be at the center of attention, but at the same time he was extraordinarily guarded about his private life. He liked to keep the many people who swirled around him swirling, but always at a distance. He tended to believe that his opinion was inevitably the right opinion, and he did not have a lot of patience for people who thought otherwise. As with Joe, there was an invisible boundary around him that he would not let others cross, and, like Joe, he was sensitive. You could never quite be sure what might set him off, shut him down, or make him lose his focus. Taunts from another boat seemed to be one of the things that did. Walking up the hill from the shell house together that night after the meeting with Obrigson, Joe and Shorty and Roger talked excitedly but in hushed voices. Al Obrigson had a long-established policy that a single training infraction would drop a man 2 shells. A second infraction would lead to his expulsion from the squad. They weren't sure whether what had just happened represented a training infraction or not, but they feared it might. Either way, they were angry at having been chewed out. Shorty in particular was agitated, getting hot under the collar. Roger moped along, looking even more morose than usual. As they rounded Frosh Pond, they muttered to one another, "Obrigson was unfair, a cold taskmaster, too hard on them, too blind to see how hard they were working. He'd do better to give a fellow an occasional pat on the back than to always demand more." He wasn't likely to change, though. They knew that much. And things were getting dangerous. They agreed that from now on they'd all better be watching one another's backs. As Joe peeled off from the group and made his way up University Avenue to the YMCA, with his shoulders hunched up and his eyes narrowed against the wind-blown rain, he passed cheap restaurants packed with giddy students